The multi-state lawsuit over the cap on salt, the state and local tax deduction stemming from last year's passage of tax reform, has been dismissed. In his statement, Governor Cuomo said New York is, quote, evaluating all options, including appeal. Albany law professor Christine Chung is here with her take on the dismissal of the salt case, as well as the decision by Chris Collins to plead guilty and resign from Congress. We think he's going to plead guilty. Anyway, it doesn't happen until 3 o'clock. But Professor Chung is here, and she's not only the co-director of the Institute for Financial Market Regulation, she's a former branch chief of the Enforcement Division of the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. So she's the right person to talk about insider trading. How are you?
I'm good.
So let's start with Collins. You told us, you know, back when he was first arrested, I don't even remember when that was, like a year and a half ago, that this was going to be pretty straightforward. So remind us what he's being charged with.
Yeah, so it was announced actually August 8th of 2018 that he had been essentially charged with insider trading. And basically, insider trading is trading on the basis of material non-public information. So the allegation was that he had received a tip from an Australian biotech company that clinical trials had not worked out as they had hoped. And then the allegation was that he then tipped his son, and there was a sort of a chain involving the son's fiance and her family to dump the stock before news became widely known in the U.S. of the failure of the clinical trials.
Are there both criminal and civil charges here?
Yeah. So insider trading law can be enforced civilly or criminally. And so when the Department of Justice gets involved, that's when you see the criminal indictment. The SEC can also bring a civil enforcement action. So there can be civil charges as well. You can have both in the same case involving the same facts.
His defense, Collins' defense, had accused federal prosecutors of violating his rights under the Constitution's speech or debate clause.
Yeah.
Can you remind us what that is and what happened?
Well, you know, I think it was a stretch of an argument, first of all, right? It was a stretch. And what the government did fairly recently was to slightly amend the indictment. So there's a superseding indictment that eliminated certain allegations and streamlined things a bit in a way that made it much harder for him to raise those arguments. And that preceded the developments that were announced on the 30th. So,
exactly is a speech or debate?
Yeah, you know, he essentially was saying that it was sort of part of sort of his deliberative process
as a congressman.
Yeah, I don't think it was a strong argument. I think it was a reach, and I mean, because remember how this played out? He was on the White House lawn at a picnic when he allegedly made the call to his son. And they were like, and I mean, there's like video of him.
I've seen that
speaking
video
on the phone. So I think he tried to tie it in some way. But it, like I said, it was a huge stretch because he was just, you know, he was on the board. There was nothing about this investment that had to do with his congressional duties, really. And so it was a stretch of an argument, in my view.
We're going to talk more about what happened with Chris Collins with Professor Christine Chung of Albany Law right after this.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Christine Chung is here. She is the co-director of the Institute for Financial Market Regulation at Albany Law School. She is also a former branch chief of the Enforcement Division of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. She knows quite a bit about insider trading. We're here talking with her about two things, the Collins case, which has, you know, directly to do with insider trading, and the Salt case, which we'll get to in a minute. But Christine Chung, when you first were on talking about the Collins case, you know, a year and a half ago or whenever it was in 2018, one of the things that Collins had brought up to stress that he was not guilty was that he didn't trade stocks. And you at the time said, well, that doesn't matter. Remind us why.
Yeah. So that's a common sort of defense that people might raise in his situation to say, I didn't trade. And first of all, let's remember why he didn't trade. He didn't trade because his shares were actually held over in Australia, and the Australian authorities had put a trading halt default on the stock. So, you know, I mean, he was precluded by Australian regulatory authorities from trading because of that action over, because the news came out first in Australia that the clinical trials had failed. But his child, his son, and some of his son's fiance's family members had gotten shares over in the U.S., and they did trade. So he is liable as a tipper. So the tipper is the person who conveys the material non-public information, and the tippy is the one who receives it. That was his son. So tipper.
That's an actual legal term, a tippy.
Yeah, it is. Isn't that right? Like, try your spell check, right?
Tipper, tippy.
Tippers and tippies, and they can both can be liable under insider trading laws for the trading done by the son and the extended network of folks who did trade. So the fact that he himself didn't trade, number one, it wasn't a reflection necessarily of virtue. His own personal shares were essentially on ice, if you will, but he did tip, and that is the basis of liability.
We heard from Michael Koenig, who is a former prosecutor, that Collins will likely receive between 2 and 4 years in federal prison. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are sentencing guidelines that guide sentencing in a case like this, and you know, we'll have to see, right? It doesn't sound out of the realm of possibility to me. You know, sentencing, I mean, he didn't cooperate, so he's not a cooperating witness, so he won't get that benefit. I mean, he is entering a plea of guilty, so there is that acceptance of responsibility, so that will weigh in his favor in sentencing.
But because he didn't plead guilty right away?
We'll hear what he says when he goes into court today at 3:00, right? But there is some benefit to acceptance of responsibility. But that isn't out of line in a case like this. I mean, it's white collar is a little bit harder sometimes predict how it's going to shake out. So I think that's well could be right.
What are the reasons that Collins could have decided to plead guilty? I mean, I know we don't know if he's even going to plead guilty. I mean, this is all happening, you know, 4 hours from now, but 3 hours from now, I should say. But what is it that could have lent to his decision-making?
Yeah, so again, as you point out, the son, I think, is going in at 2, and Representative Collins, or I guess ex-Representative Collins, is going in at 3, so we'll hear. But he did resign, and if he does enter a plea of guilty, which is what is anticipated, because he did file file with the court indicating a change of plea would be happening, I think a couple of things. Number one, the government had him. I mean, the evidence was very strong. It's always circumstantial in the sense that nobody wiretapped the call to his son, but there are text messages exchanged between extended, you know, the family members, the son and the relatives discussing getting out of the stock. The fiance and her mother settled with the SEC. So there were settlements out there where they accepted sanctions connected with their own trading activity. It was a very strong case. And especially after the government made some modifications or amendments to the indictment to address what I think were weak anyway, speech and debate clause arguments, you know, this was going to be a hard case for him to win.
Could any of this have to do with leniency for his son?
We'll have to see. I don't think we'll know until 2, right? I do think that there are situations in which, a decision to sort of be more lenient with respect to a child can influence decision making. I think we've seen that in the Varsity Blues case, where Felicity Huffman took an early plea and said that, you know, her child had been unaware and was uninvolved and got a very light sentence, right? So that may turn out to be. But, you know, his son was also fighting it and is only now potentially entering a plea of guilty. We won't know until 2.
Okay.
So, I think it was just going to be a hard case to win. And it's sooner or later you have that moment of reckoning where you have to decide, am I going to try this and risk a much more severe sanction, or am I going to settle?
And he opted to he's opting, we think.
We think.
Okay. We'll know more at 3 p.m.
Exactly.
Let's switch to the dismissal of the Salt case. What is this one about and who's involved?
Yeah, so this was a case filed by the states of New York, Connecticut, Maryland, and New Jersey having to do with the tax act that was, you know, that the tax quote reform act, and essentially the claim said that one of the things that the act did was limit SALT, what are called SALT deductions.
It capped
SALT
it.
Meaning state and local tax deductions, so things like your property tax, and it limited them, whereas before it had been unlimited. And so for residents of these states, New York, Connecticut, Maryland, New Jersey, high property tax states, the claim was that by limiting the SALT deduction, the federal government was essentially intruding into areas that were the purview of the states and attempting to coerce the states to change their taxing policy to align with federal tax policy.
Now, the federal judge who heard the case said, nah, no,
right.
I'm not buying that argument. The states said that the SALT cap was an unconstitutional assault on state sovereign choices. The judge didn't buy it.
Yep.
Was that a good argument, though? I mean, is it something, if the states appeal, can you see them, you know, making another judge buy it?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. The state's core claim on the merits was that the SALT cap, that the elimination of the SALT cap exceeded federal tax power by verging into territory that is constitutionally reserved to the states. That's how the court summarized the argument. So essentially intruding and coercing, if you will. I think that the argument makes intuitive sense, right? But it butts up against the fact that the federal government has expansive powers with respect to taxation. So there's no question that the SALT tax is sort of been there from the idea of the deduction has been there from the beginning. But what hasn't been there from the beginning is this idea that the federal government is precluded from capping it. And that's going to be that's a hard argument because, again, the state has, the state's powers, you know, don't overcome the broad federal powers here. So I don't think I don't think that there's no shot, but I think it's tough given expansive federal powers.
We'll see if the states appeal. Albany Law Professor Christine Chung, co-director of the Institute for Financial Market Regulation at Albany Law School. It's great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we are going to miss you.
Oh, I'll be around.
Okay, good.
And I want to thank you for joining us. Our producer has been Tim Williams.
Howdy.
Our engineer, Dave White. I'm Susan Arbetter. You've been listening to the Capitol Press Room.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.